For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood. It's Oscar season, so let's look at some books that have been adapted into winners of the Best Picture Oscar. I first compiled this list a few years back, but thought it was the right time for a refresh and an update. The rules are simple. The book has to be adapted into a movie, the movie has to have won Best Picture Oscar, and the audio version of the book has to be available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. So sit back, grab your popcorn, and on with the show. At the first Academy Awards in 1928, there was no award for Best Picture. Instead, there were two separate awards, one called Most Outstanding Production, which was won by the epic Wings, and one called Most Artistic Quality of Production, which was won by the art film Sunrise. The next year, the Academy decided on a single award called Best Production, and decided retroactively that the award won by Wings was the equivalent of Best Production, with the result that Wings is often listed as the first winner of Best Picture. Best Production became Best Picture in 1931, and until 1950 it was given to the studio who produced the film and not the producers themselves. Many of the films that have won the awards, more than we have time for today actually, have been adapted from books. After Wings, it was won by Broadway Melody, and the year after that by our first book, All Quiet on the Western Front. The book was published in 1929, and it's a novel by Erich Maria Remarque, a German veteran of World War I. In 1914, at the age of 18, the author went straight from school into the army and was sent to the Western Front. During the course of the war, his mother died, and all his friends were killed. At the end of the war, he found himself alone in the world. This book tells the sacrifice of a generation. This book and its sequel, The Road Back, were among the books banned and burned in Nazi Germany, although it sold 2.5 million copies in 25 languages in its first 18 months in print.
It is strange to think that at home, in the drawer of my writing table, there lies the beginning of a play called Saul and a bundle of poems. Many an evening I have worked over them. We all did something of the kind. But that has become so unreal to me, I cannot comprehend it any more. Our early life is cut off from the moment we came here, and that without our lifting a hand. We often try to look back on it and to find an explanation, but never quite succeed. For us young men of 20, everything is extraordinarily vague, for Krop, Müller, Leia, and for me, for all of us whom Kantorek calls the Iron Youth. All the older men are linked up with their previous life. They have wives, children, occupations and interests. They have a background which is so strong that the war cannot obliterate it. We young men of 20, however, have only our parents and some, perhaps, a girl. That is not much.
Robert Gladwell reading from the RNIB version of All Quiet on the Western Front. And this book was the sort of spark that inspired this revisit to the Oscar show, as in 2023, All Quiet on the Western Front is once again up for Best Picture. This version is directed by Edward Berger and is currently available on Netflix. But could this be the first time that a movie and its remake have both won Best Picture? In 1935, the winner of the Best Outstanding Production was It Happened One Night, based on the short story Night Bus by Samuel Hopkins Adams. The very next year, it was Mutiny on the Bounty by Charles Nordhoff and James Norman Hall, which is available from RNIB Talking Books, but only as a BBC drama. move on to the book that inspired the Best Picture winner in 1939 in a minute, but let's look at 1937, The Life of Emile Zola. It's a biographical film about the famous French author, depicting his friendship with noted painter Paul Cézanne and his rise to fame through his prolific writing, with particular focus on his involvement in the Dreyfus Affair. The source material for this film is a book called Zola and His Time by Matthew Josephson, and it was written in 1928, but unfortunately isn't available as an RNIB talking book. However, many of Zola's books are. There are 12 in total, including the famous Nana, the writing of which is detailed in the film. But let's move on to 1939, and we're Gone with the Wind. Margaret Mitchell's book Gone with the Wind was published in May 1936, and it won the Pulitzer Prize in 1937. The story is set in Clayton County, Georgia, and Atlanta during the American Civil War and Reconstruction, and depicts the experiences of Scarlett O'Hara, the spoiled daughter of a well-to-do plantation owner. The sales of the book in the summer of 1936, at the virtually unprecedented price of $3, reached around 1 million by the end of December. Favourable critics found in the novel and its success an implicit rejection of what one reviewer dismissed as all the thousands of technical tricks our novelists have been playing with for the past 20 years, while from the ramparts of the critical establishment, almost universally male reviewers lamented the book's literary mediocrity and labelled it mere entertainment. The film was made 3 years later and won the Best Picture Oscar in 1939.
"I don't want any explanation from you, and I won't listen to one," said Melanie firmly, as she gently laid a small hand across Scarlett's tortured lips and stilled her words. "You insult yourself and Ashley and me by even thinking there could be need of explanations between us. Why, we three have been like soldiers fighting the world together for so many years that I'm ashamed of you for thinking idle gossip could come between us. Do you think I believe that you and my Ashley? Why, the idea! Don't you realize I know you better than anyone in the world knows you? Do you think I've forgotten all the wonderful, unselfish things you've done for Ashley and Beau and me, everything from saving my life to keeping us from starving? Do you think I could remember you walking in a furrow behind that Yankee's horse, almost barefooted and with your hands blistered, just so the baby and I could have something to eat? And then believe such dreadful things about you? I don't want to hear a word out of you, Scarlett O'Hara. Not a word. But..." Scarlett fumbled and stopped. Rhett had left town the hour before with Bonnie and Prissy, and desolation was added to Scarlett's shame and anger. The additional burden of her guilt with Ashley and Melanie's defense was more than she could bear. Had Melanie believed India and Archie, cut her at the reception, or even greeted her frigidly, then she could have held her head high and fought back with every weapon in her armory. But now, with the memory of Melanie standing between her and social ruin, standing like a thin, shining blade, with trust and a fighting light in her eyes, there seemed nothing honest to do but confess. Yes, blurt out everything from that far-off beginning on the sunny porch at Tara.
That's a clip from the book Gone with the Wind, narrated by Liza Ross. Set in Georgia at the time of the Civil War, this is the story of headstrong Scarlett O'Hara, her three marriages, and her determination to keep her father's property of Tara, despite the vicissitudes of war and passion. This book is 43 hours and 5 minutes long, and it's available as an RNIB talking book, catalogue number 15050. Gone with the Wind, the film, won the Best Picture Oscar in 1939, and nominations that year included some other great books, including Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Of Mice and Men, and Wuthering Heights. But the very next year, the Best Picture Oscar was won by Rebecca.
Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. It seemed to me I stood by the iron gate leading to the drive, and for a while I could not enter, for the way was barred to me. There was a padlock and a chain upon the gate. I called in my dream to the lodgekeeper and had no answer, and peering closer through the rusted spokes of the gate, I saw that the lodge was uninhabited. No smoke came from the chimney, and the little lattice windows gaped forlorn. Then, like all dreamers, I was possessed of a sudden with supernatural powers, and passed like a spirit through the barrier before me. The drive wound away in front of me, twisting and turning as it had always done, but as I advanced, I was aware that a change had come upon it. It was narrow and unkept, not the drive that we had known. At first I was puzzled and did not understand, and it was only when I bent my head to avoid the low-swinging branch of a tree that I realised what had happened. Nature had come into her own again, and little by little, in her stealthy, insidious way, had encroached upon the drive with long, tenacious fingers.
That was Janita Jimenez reading Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca. Working as a lady's companion, the heroine of Rebecca learns her place. Her future looks bleak, until on a trip to the south of France, she meets Max de Winter, a handsome widower whose sudden proposal of marriage takes her by surprise. She accepts, but whisked from glamorous Monte Carlo to the ominous and brooding Manderley, the new Mrs. de Winter finds Max a changed man, and the memory of his dead wife Rebecca is forever kept alive by the forbidding housekeeper, Mrs. Danvers.
That talking book of Rebecca is available from RNIB, and the Alfred Hitchcock film won in 1941. In 1942, John Ford directed the best picture, How Green Was My Valley. The book, by Robert Llewellyn, is narrated by Andrew Timothy.
Owen had a voice deep and from the chest, and to hear him read in chapel was a shock. So good it sounded, echoing up in the gallery and under the rafters. My father had a notion to put him up as a preacher, but Owen was not yet old enough, and in any case he liked better to use tools than study, though even then he knew almost any part of the Bible by heart. I forget what exactly Davy and my father were talking about. I think it was about coal raising and the way the seam ran down the valley. "They're all fools," Owen said. Davy was so surprised that he put down his knife and fork. "Hisht, Owen," my mother said, and looked at my father with wide eyes. None of us were allowed to speak unless my father spoke to us first. My father chewed what was in his mouth as though he hadn't heard. But as soon as he'd swallowed, he turned to look at Owen as though he'd never seen him before. "And what," he said, "what do you know about the subject?"
Growing up in a mining community in rural South Wales, Hugh Morgan is taught many harsh lessons. Looking back, we are difficult days, are faced with courage, and the valleys swell with the sound of Welsh voices, it becomes clear that there is nowhere so green as the landscape of his own memory. The talking book lasts 18 hours and is narrated by Andrew Timothy. We'll skip past a couple of Oscar-winning books, such as Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne, which won in 1957, and Gigi and the Cat by Colette, the short story that inspired the musical Gigi, and pause quickly in 1963 for the David Lean-directed film based on Seven Pillars of Wisdom by T.E. Lawrence.
Some of the evil of my tale may have been inherent in our circumstances. For years we lived anyhow with one another, in the naked desert, under the indifferent heaven. By day, the hot sun fermented us, and we were dizzied by the beating wind. At night, we were stained by dew and shamed into pettiness by the innumerable silences of stars.
Seven Pillars of Wisdom is the autobiographical account of T.E. Lawrence, of his service in the Arab Revolt during the First World War. Continually and bitterly ashamed that the Arabs had risen in revolt against the Turks as a result of fraudulent British promises of self-rule, Lawrence of Arabia led them in a triumphant campaign which revolutionised the art of war. The audio version from RNIB is narrated by Alvar Liddell. We're looking at the books behind the winners of the Best Picture Oscar. And so far we've looked at classics All Quiet on the Western Front, Gone with the Wind and Rebecca. But let's bring things a little more up to date and head to 1972 and to 1974, when the Best Picture Oscar was won by The Godfather and then The Godfather Part 2.
The Don was a real man at the age of 12. Short, dark, slender, living in the strange Moorish-looking village of Corleone in Sicily, he had been born Vito Andolini. But when strange men came to kill the son of the man they had murdered, his mother sent the young boy to America to stay with friends. And in the new land, he changed his name to Corleone to preserve some tie with his native village. It was one of the few gestures of sentiment he was ever to make. In Sicily, at the turn of the century, the Mafia was the second government, far more powerful than the official one in Rome. Vito Corleone's father became involved in a feud with another villager who took his case to the Mafia. The father refused to knuckle under, and in a public quarrel, killed the local Mafia chief. A week later, he himself was found dead, his body torn apart by Lupara blasts. A month after the funeral, Mafia gunmen came inquiring after the young boy, Vito. They decided that he was too close to manhood, that he might try to avenge the death of his father in the years to come. The 12-year-old Vito was hidden by relatives and shipped to America. There he was boarded with the Abbandandos, whose son Genko was later to become consigliere to his Don. Young Vito went to work in the Abbandando grocery store on 9th Avenue in New York's Hell's Kitchen. At the age of 18, Vito married an Italian girl freshly arrived from Sicily, a girl of only 16, but a skilled cook, a good housewife. They settled down in a tenement on 10th Avenue, near 35th Street, only a few blocks from where Vito worked. And 2 years later, were blessed with their first child, Santino, called by all his friends Sonny because of his devotion to his father. In the neighborhood lived a man called Fanucci. He was a heavy-set, fierce-looking Italian who wore expensive light-colored suits and a cream-colored fedora. This man was reputed to be of the Black Hand, an offshoot of the Mafia, which extorted money from families and storekeepers by threat of physical violence. However, since most of the inhabitants of the neighborhood were violent themselves, Fanucci's threats of bodily harm were effective only with elderly couples without male children to defend them. Some of the storekeepers paid him trifling sums as a matter of convenience. However, Fanucci was also a scavenger on fellow criminals, people who illegally sold Italian lottery tickets or ran gambling games in their homes. The Abbandando grocery gave him a small tribute, this despite the protests of young Genko, who told his father he would settle the Fanucci hash. His father forbade him. Vito Corleone observed all this without feeling in any way involved. One day, Fanucci was set upon by three young men who cut his throat from ear to ear, not deeply enough to kill him, but enough to frighten him and make him bleed a great deal. Vito saw Fanucci fleeing from his punishers, the circular slash flowing red. What he never forgot was Fanucci holding the cream-colored fedora under his chin to catch the dripping blood as he ran, as if he did not want his suit soiled, or did not want to leave a shameful trail of carmine. But this attack proved a blessing in disguise for Fanucci. The three young men were not murderers, merely tough young boys determined to teach him a lesson and stop him from scavenging. Fanucci proved himself a murderer. A few weeks later, the knife wielder was shot to death, and the families of the other two young men paid an indemnity to Fanucci to make him forswear his vengeance. After that, the tributes became higher, and Fanucci became a partner in the neighborhood gambling games. As for Vito Corleone, it was none of his affair. He forgot about it immediately.
Jeff Harding reading from Mario Puzo's The Godfather. It's available from RNIB Libraries. It's unsuitable for family reading, contains language that might be considered offensive, and scenes of violence that might be considered offensive. No surprise there. The Godfather won Best Picture in 1972, The Godfather 2 won in 1974, and the very next year, another book inspired Hollywood. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
They don't bother not talking out loud about their hate secrets when I'm nearby, because they think I'm deaf and dumb. Everybody thinks so. I'm cagey enough to fool them that much. If my being half Indian ever helped me in any way in this dirty life, it helped me being cagey. Helped me all these years. I'm mopping near the ward door when a key hits it from the other side, and I know it's the big nurse by the way the lock works cleave to the key, soft and swift and familiar she's been around locks so long. She slides through the door with a gust of cold and locks the door behind her, and I see her fingers trail across the polished steel, tip of each finger the same color as her lips. Funny orange. Like the tip of a soldering iron. Color so hot or so cold, if she touches you with it, you can't tell which. She's carrying her woven wicker bag, like the ones the Umpqua tribe sells out along the hot August highway. A bag shape of a toolbox with a hemp handle. She's had it all the years I've been here. It's a loose weave, and I can see inside it. There's no compact or lipstick or woman stuff. She's got that bag full of 1,000 parts she aims to use in her duties today. Wheels and gears, cogs polished to a hard glitter. Tiny pills that gleam like porcelain. Needles, forceps, watchmaker's pliers, rolls of copper wire. She dips a nod at me as she goes past. I let the mop push me back to the wall and smile and try to foul her equipment up as much as possible by not letting her see my eyes. They can't tell so much about you as you've got your eyes closed. In my dark, I hear her rubber heels hit the tile and the stuff in her wicker bag clash with the jar of her walking as she passes me in the hall. She walks stiff. When I open my eyes, she's down the hall, about to turn into the glass nurse's station, where she'll spend the day sitting at her desk and looking out her window and making notes on what goes on out in front of her in the day room during the next 8 hours. Her face looks pleased and peaceful with the thought.
Life in an American mental hospital as told by the chief, a half-Indian who is driven to feign being deaf and dumb for many years in order to survive the rigours and traumas of institutional life. He is the spectator without responsibility for many of the incidents, some hilarious, some very moving, in this struggle between bureaucracy and the individual. The audio version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is narrated by Jonathan Oliver. On today's Read On, the audiobook show, we're listening to books that were adapted into winners of the Best Picture Oscar. And in the 90s and noughties, almost half of those winners originated as books. Starting in 1991 with a book that itself was a sequel. The follow-up to Robert Harris's Red Dragon is called The Silence of the Lambs.
Dr. Lecter's cell is well beyond the others, facing only a closet across the corridor. And it is unique in other ways. The front is a wall of bars, but within the bars, at a distance greater than the human reach, is a second barrier, a stout nylon net stretched from floor to ceiling and wall to wall. Behind the net, Starling could see a table bolted to the floor and piled high with soft cover books and papers, and a straight chair also fastened down. Dr. Hannibal Lecter himself reclined on his bunk, perusing the Italian edition of Vogue. He held the loose pages in his right hand and put them beside him one by one with his left. Dr. Lecter has six fingers on his left hand. Clarice Starling stopped a little distance from the bars, about the length of a small foyer. Dr. Lecter? Her voice sounded all right to her. He looked up from his reading. For a steep second, she thought his gaze hummed, but it was only her blood she heard. My name is Clarice Starling. May I talk with you? Courtesy was implicit in her distance and her tone. Dr. Lecter considered, his finger pressed against his pursed lips. Then he rose in his own time and came forward smoothly in his cage, stopping short of the nylon web without looking at it, as though he chose the distance. She could see that he was small, sleek. In his hands and arms, she saw wiry strength like her own. Good morning, he said, as though he had answered the door. His cultured voice had a slight metallic rasp beneath it, possibly from disuse. Dr. Lecter's eyes are maroon, and they reflect the light in pinpoints of red. Sometimes the points of light seem to fly like sparks to his center. His eyes held Starling whole. She came a measured distance closer to the bars. The hair on her forearms rose and pressed against her sleeves. Doctor, we're having a hard problem in psychological profiling. I want to ask you for your help. We being behavioral science at Quantico. You're one of Jack Crawford's, I expect. I am, yes. May I see your credentials? She hadn't expected this. I showed them at the office. You mean you showed them to Frederick Chilton, Ph.D.? Yes. Did you see his credentials? No. The academic ones don't make extensive reading, I can tell you. Did you meet Alan? Isn't he charming? Which of them had you rather talk with? On the whole, I'd say Alan. You could be a reporter, Chilton, let in for money. I think I'm entitled to see your credentials. All right. She held up her laminated ID card. I can't read it at this distance. Send it through, please. I can't. Because it's hard. Yes. Ask Barney. The orderly came and considered. Dr. Lecter, I'll let this come through. But if you don't return it when I ask you to, if we have to bother everybody and secure you to get it, then I'll be upset. If you upset me, you'll have to stay bundled up until I feel better towards you. Meals through the tube. Dignity pants changed twice a day, the works. And I'll hold your mail for a week. Got it? Certainly, Barney. The card rolled through on the tray and Dr. Lecter held it to the light.
But trainee. It says trainee. Jack Crawford sent a trainee to interview me.
He tapped the card against his small white teeth and breathed in its smell.
Dr. Lecter,
Barney said. Of course. He put the card back in the tray carrier, and Barney pulled it to the outside.
Nigel Graham reading from The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris. A killer is attacking women across the USA. His methods are horrifying. His motives unknown. He has a purpose, but no one can fathom it. No one except Dr. Hannibal Lecter, brilliant psychiatrist and homicidal genius, now confined in strict isolation in a hospital for the criminally insane. Clarice Starling, a young FBI trainee, is assigned to interview Lecter. It contains passages of violence that might be considered offensive, and it lasts 10 hours 54 minutes. RNIB catalogue number 8469. In 1993, the Best Picture was won by Schindler's List. The book tells the story of Oskar Schindler, a Nazi party member who turns into the unlikely hero. By the end of the war, Schindler saved 1,200 Jews from concentration camps all over Poland and Germany, and it was written by Thomas Keneally. Keneally was inspired to write the book by Poldek Pfeifferberg, a Holocaust survivor. After the war, Pfeifferberg had tried on a number of occasions to interest the screenwriters and filmmakers he met through his business in a film based on the story of Schindler and his actions in saving Polish Jews from the Nazis, arranging several interviews with Schindler for American television. In October 1980, Keneally went to Pfeifferberg's shop in Beverly Hills to buy a briefcase. Keneally had just finished a book signing and was on his way home to Australia. Pfeifferberg learned that Keneally was a novelist, showed him his extreme files on Schindler, and after 50 minutes, Pfeifferberg was able to convince Keneally to write the book.
The factory produced nothing. Not a shell, Brinlitz prisoners will still say, shaking their heads. Not one 45mm shell manufactured there could be used, not one rocket casing. Oskar himself contrasts the turnover of DEF in the Krakow years with the Brinlitz record. In Zablokje, enamelware was manufactured to the value of 16 million Reichsmarks. During the same time, the armament section of the Zablokje plant produced shells worth 500,000 Reichsmarks. Oskar explains that at Brinlitz, however, as a consequence of the falling off of the enamel production, there was no output to speak of. The armaments production, he says, encountered starting difficulties. But in fact, he did manage to ship one truck full of ammunition parts valued at 35,000 Reichsmarks during the Brinlitz months. These parts, said Oskar later, had been transferred to Brinlitz already half-made. To supply still less to the war effort was impossible, and the excuse of teething troubles became more and more dangerous for me and my Jews because Speer, the armaments minister, raised his demands from month to month. The danger of Oskar's policy of non-production was not only that it gave him a bad name at the armaments ministry, it made other managements angry. For the factory system was fragmented. One workshop producing the shells, another the fuses, a third packing in the high explosives and assembling the components. In this way, it was reasoned, an air raid on any one factory could not substantially destroy the flow of armaments. Oskar's shells, dispatched by freight to factories farther down the line, were inspected there by engineers Oskar did not know and could not reach. The Brinlitz items always failed quality control. Oskar would show the complaining letters to Stern, to Finder, to Pemper or Gard. He would laugh uproariously as if the men writing the reprimands were comic, fustian bureaucrats. Moving forward in time and taking one such case, Itzhak Stern and Mietek Pemper were in Oskar's office on the morning of April the 28th, 1945. a morning when the prisoners stood at an extremity of danger, having been, as will be seen, all condemned to death by Sturmbannführer Hasbrook. The day was Oscar's 37th birthday, and a bottle of cognac had already been opened to mark it. And on the desk lay a telegram from the armaments assembly plant near Brno. It said that Oscar's anti-tank shells were so badly produced that they failed all quality control tests. They were imprecisely calibrated, and because they had not been tempered at the right heat, they split under testing. Oscar was ecstatic at this telegram, pushing it towards Stern and Pemper, making them read it. Pemper remembers that he made another of his outrageous utterances. "It's the best birthday present I could have got, because I know now that no poor bastard has been killed by my product."
Gordon DeLue reading from the RNIB talking book, Schindler's Ark. After the publication of the book in 1982, the inspiration behind the book, Poldek Pfeifferberg, worked to persuade Steven Spielberg to film the book, using his acquaintance with Spielberg's mother to gain access. And the film went on to win the Oscar for Best Picture in 1993. The book actually also won the Booker Prize, which caused some controversy at the time, as this is an award for the best fiction. It was debated on whether Keneally wrote fiction or was simply reporting on history. Schindler's Ark is available as an RNIB talking book narrated by Gordon DeLue. It lasts 15 hours, 29 minutes, and it's talking book number 4714.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, "Alexa, call RNIB helpline" for more information. RNIB. See differently.
We're listening to some of the books that were made into films which won the Best Picture Oscar. And in 1994, the winner was Forrest Gump.
Let me say this. Being an idiot is no box of chocolates. When people laugh, lose patience, treat you shabby. Now, they say folks supposed to be kind to the afflicted. Let me tell you, it ain't always that way. Yeah, even so, I got no complaints. Because I reckon I done live a pretty interesting life, so to speak.
William DeVries reading from Winston Groom's book Forrest Gump, which was first released as a novel in 1986. The film does differ substantially from the book. The book describes itself as a warm and funny tale told by an idiot. Follow Forrest from football dynasties to the Vietnam War, from encounters with Presidents Johnson and Nixon to powwows with Chairman Mao. Go with him to a Hollywood movie set, on a professional wrestling tour, and into space on the oddest NASA mission ever.
I've been an idiot since I was born. My IQ is near 70, which qualifies me, so to say. Probably, though, I'm closer being an imbecile or maybe even a moron. But personally, I'd rather think of myself as like a half-wit or something, and not no idiot. Now, I'm slow, I'll grant you that. I'm probably a lot brighter than folks think. 'Cause what goes on in my mind is a sight different than what folks see. For instance, I can think things pretty good, but when I got to try saying or writing them, it kind of come out like jello or something.
Winston Groom wrote a sequel in 1995 called Gump and Co. In the very first page of the sequel, Forrest Gump tells readers, "Don't never let nobody make a movie of your life's story. Though whether they get it wrong or right, it don't matter." Forrest Gump by Winston Groom, narrated by William DeVries, is available as an RNIB talking book, lasting 7 hours and 9 minutes. It's catalogue number 103 0101. In 2001, the Best Picture Oscar was won by A Beautiful Mind. The film was based on an unauthorised biography of John Forbes Nash Jr. by Sylvia Nassar, and although it's not available as an RNIB talking book, it's available commercially. It lasts 18 hours, 8 minutes, and it's narrated by Anna Fields. In 2003, the Oscar for Best Picture went to a second sequel. Part 3 in the Lord of the Rings trilogy is The Return of the King.
Sam had just wits enough left to thrust the file back into his breast.
"Run, Mr. Frodo,"
he cried.
"No, not that way. There's a sheer drop over the wall. Follow me."
Down the road from the gate they fled. In 50 paces, with a swift bend round a jutting bastion of the cliff, it took them out of sight from the tower. They had escaped for the moment. Cowering back against the rock, they drew breath, and then they clutched at their hearts. Perching now on the wall beside the ruined gate, the Nazgul sent out its deadly cries. All the cliffs echoed. In terror, they stumbled on. Soon the road bent sharply eastward again, and exposed them for a dreadful moment to a view from the tower. As they flitted across, they glanced back and saw the great black shape upon the battlement. Then they plunged down between high rock walls in a cutting that fell steeply to join the Morgul road. They came to the way-meeting. There was still no sign of orcs, nor of an answer to the cry of the Nazgul. But they knew that the silence would not last long. At any moment now, the hunt would begin.
David Banks, reading from J.R.R. Tolkien's The Return of the King, being the third part of The Lord of the Rings, a saga of dwarves, elves, and fierce goblins of long ago, and the story of Frodo, who through the ring sets out to save his world from evil. All of the books are available from RNIB Library, The Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, and The Return of the King. Also available are The Hobbit and The Silmarillion, as well as two books of short stories, Unfinished Tales and The Father Christmas Letters, all by J.R.R. Tolkien, and all available from RNIB. Next up, we have another Booker winner, or actually a joint winner of the Booker Prize in 1992, Michael Ondaatje's The English Patient. Exploring the lives of four people, a young woman and three men stranded in a damaged villa north of Florence as the war retreats around them. In an upstairs room lies the badly burned English patient, alive but unable to move. His extraordinary adventures and turbulent love affair in the North African desert before the war provide the focus around which the vivid tales of his companions revolve.
She turns into the room, which is another garden. This one made up of trees and bowers, painted over its walls and ceiling. The man lies on the bed, his body exposed to the breeze, and he turns his head slowly towards her as she enters. Every 4 days she washes his black body, beginning at the destroyed feet. She wets a washcloth, and holding it above his ankles, squeezes the water onto him, looking up as he murmurs, seeing his smile. Above the shins the burns are worst. Beyond purple, bone. She has nursed him for months, and she knows the body well. The thin, tight hips. Hip bones of Christ, she thinks. He is her despairing saint. He lies flat on his back, no pillow, looking up at the foliage painted onto the ceiling, its canopy of branches, and above that, blue sky. She pours calamine in stripes across his chest, where he is less burnt, where she can touch him. She loves the hollow below the lowest rib, its cliff of skin. Reaching his shoulders, she blows cool air onto his neck, and he mutters, "What?" she asks, coming out of her concentration. He turns his dark face with its grey eyes towards her. She puts her hand into her pocket. She unskins the plum with her teeth, withdraws the stone, and passes the flesh of the fruit into his mouth. He whispers again, dragging the listening heart of the young nurse beside him to wherever his mind is, into that well of memory he kept plunging into during those months before he died.
Peter Wickham reading from Michael Ondaatje's The English Patient. The film of the book, written for the screen and directed by Anthony Minghella, won the Best Picture Oscar in 1996, although Ondaatje worked closely with the filmmakers throughout the entire process. In fact, in his book The Conversations, Walter Murch and the Art of Editing Film from 2002, he records his conversations with the film's editor and sound designer, who won two Academy Awards for the film. The English Patient is available as an RNIB talking book lasting 9 hours and 43 minutes. In No Country for Old Men, Llewellyn Moss, whilst out hunting, finds men shot dead, a load of heroin and more than $2 million in cash. Taking the money he knows will change everything. But only after two more men are murdered does a victim's burning car lead Sheriff Bell to the carnage out in the desert, and he soon realises that Moss and his young wife are in desperate need of protection. The Sheriff's a laconic World War II veteran who oversees the investigation and the trail of murders, even as he struggles to face the sheer enormity of the crimes he is attempting to solve. It's his reminiscences that serve as part of the book's narration.
I don't know if law enforcement work is more dangerous now than what it used to be or not. I know when I first took office, you'd have a fist fight somewheres, and you'd go to break it up, and they'd offer to fight you. And sometimes you had to accommodate them. They wouldn't have it no other way. And you'd better not lose, neither. You don't see that so much no more, but maybe you see worse. I had a man pull a gun on me one time, and it happened that I grabbed it just as he went to fire, and the plunger on the hammer went right through the fleshy part of my thumb. You can see the mark of it there. But that man had every intention of killing me. A few years ago, and it wasn't that many neither, I was going out one of these little two-lane blacktop roads of a night, and I come up on a pickup truck that there was two old boys setting in the bed of it. They kindly blinked in the lights, and I backed off some. But the truck had Coa Wheeler plates on it, and I thought, well, I need to stop these old boys and take a look. So I hit the lights, and whenever I'd done that, I seen the slider window in the back of the cab open, and here comes somebody passing a shotgun out the window to the old boy sitting in the bed of the truck. I tell you right now, I hit them brakes with both feet. It skidded the unit sideways to where the lights was going out into the brush. But the last thing I seen in the bed of the truck was the old boy putting that shotgun to his shoulder. I hit the seat, and I just had hit it when here come the windshield all over me and them little bitty pieces they break up into. I still had one foot on the brake, and I could feel the cruiser sliding down into the bar ditch. And I thought it was going to roll, but it didn't. It filled the car just full of dirt. The old boy, he opened up on me twice more and shot all the glass out of one side of the cruiser, and by then I'd come to a stop. And I laid there in the seat, had my pistol out, and I heard that pickup leave out, and I raised up and fired several shots at the taillights. But they was long gone.
William Roberts reading from Cormac McCarthy's book, No Country for Old Men. It's available as an RNIB talking book lasting 7 hours and 14 minutes, and it's catalogue number 15071. In 2008, the Best Picture Oscar was won by Slumdog Millionaire. The inspiration for this film is a novel called Q&A by Vicky Swarup. Published in 2005, it was the author's first novel. Set in India, it tells the story of former Tiffin boy Ram Mohammed Thomas as he makes television game show history. Prior to the start of the novel, Ram has correctly answered 12 questions on the fictional game show Who Will Win a Billion and has won a billion rupees, which is about $22 million. However, show host Prem Kumar and the producers, who do not have the money to pay him, have had him arrested for cheating by the police. They had cast Ram because they figured an uneducated street lad would not be able to answer more than a few questions at most, and they find the police more than willing to believe them. Ram explains how he was able to answer the questions because they related to real events that occurred in his life, with each question prompting its own flashback.
We are still in the commercial break. Prem Kumar is in a corner conferring with a long-haired producer. I look around the studio, at the nice panelling, the spotlights, the multiple cameras, the high-tech sound system. Many members of the audience are watching me, wondering perhaps what is going through my mind. Prem Kumar ends his consultation and walks up to me. He has a sinister grin on his face.
Thomas, we don't know how you have managed to answer 11 questions so far. But there is no way you will be able to answer the final question.
We'll see.
No, I'll see. Prepare yourself to lose all, says Prem Kumar and sits down on his seat.
The studio sign changes to applause. The signature tune comes on. The audience claps loudly. Prem Kumar looks at the camera.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are standing at the brink of a historic moment, not just for this show, but perhaps for posterity. Ram Mohammed Thomas, an 18-year-old waiter from Mumbai, has gone further than any other contestant on this show. He is now about to create another milestone. If he answers this last question correctly, he will win the biggest jackpot in history, 1 billion rupees. If he fails to give me the correct answer, he will lose the single largest sum of money ever to be lost by an individual in 60 seconds, 100 million rupees. Either way, history will be made. So please clear your minds, fill your hearts and join me in saluting once again our contestant tonight, Mr. Ram Mohammed Thomas.
The studio sign changes to applause. Everyone, even Prem Kumar, stands up and there is sustained clapping. I must admire the tactics of W3B. I am being feted before being sent off the show without a penny. Like a lamb, they are fattening me with adulation before slaughtering me on the next question. The moment I have been waiting for and dreading has finally arrived. I take a deep breath and prepare to face my destiny.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am about to reveal question number 12. The final question for 1 billion rupees, the biggest prize ever offered in the history of the planet. And remember, we are still in play or pay mode. So it is win all or lose all. Okay, without any further ado, here is the last question for you, Mr. Thomas. And this is from the pages of history.
That's Christopher Simpson reading Q&A by Vikas Swarup, filmed as Slumdog Millionaire. The author said he was inspired to write the story by the Hole in the Wall project, which installed a computer in a Delhi slum. Young children taught themselves about the use of computers without intervention from the experimenters. The author also says another inspiration was the cheating scandal involving Major Charles Ingram after he won the top prize on the UK version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Swarup said if a British Army major can be accused of cheating, then a Tiffin boy from the world's biggest slum can definitely be accused of cheating.
The RNIB talking book lasts 10 hours, 48 minutes, and it's catalogue number 16469. In 2014, the Oscar for Best Picture was won by 12 Years a Slave. 12 Years a Slave is an 1853 memoir and slave narrative by American Solomon Northup, as told to and edited by David Wilson. Northup, a black man who was born free in New York State, details his being tricked to go to Washington, D.C., where he was kidnapped and sold into slavery in the Deep South. After having been kept in bondage for 12 years in Louisiana by various masters, Northup was able to write to friends and family in New York, who in turn secured his release with the aid of the state.
12 Years a Slave is a tale of deception, violence, and callous disregard for the human rights we now take for granted. It is a true story, and over a century and a half after it was published, it still has the power to shock and shame.
The account provides extensive details on the slave markets in Washington, D.C. and in New Orleans, and describes at length cotton and sugar cultivation and slave treatment on major plantations in Louisiana. The memoir has been adapted twice, produced as the 1984 television movie Solomon Northup's Odyssey and the Oscar-winning 2013 film 12 Years a Slave. The audio version, available from RNIB, is narrated by Tommy Errol Jenkins.
I was in sore distress, in most excruciating agony. I seemed to stand on the brink of madness. The memory of that night of horrible suffering will follow me to the grave. In the course of an hour or more after my return from the kitchen, I was conscious of someone entering my room. There seemed to be several, a mingling of various voices, but how many or who they were, I cannot tell.
That's it for our packed Oscars show on Read On for this week. Remember, every book we featured is available for free from RNIB Talking Books, along with over 30,000 other books. To join, call 0303 123 9999 or simply search for RNIB Library.